This is an RNZ podcast.
Kia ora te whānau. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Duncan Smith.
And I'm Sally Round. Hello. Today, a trapping network making inroads on New Zealand's pest problem.
Lee has been chatting to an Otorohanga local who swapped a freezer for a sewing machine nearly 50 years ago and hasn't looked back since.
And for those beer lovers among you, we hop down with Cosmo to New Zealand's southernmost commercial hop garden.
But first to our roundup of the week's agricultural news. RNZ's rural news reporter Maya Burry joins us from Otautahi, Christchurch. And it's a busy time on the vineyards. The grape harvest is getting underway.
Kia ora, Sally and Duncan. Yes, I remember a few years ago, Country Life did do a whole series on wine production. So this is probably a topic a few listeners are pretty clued up on. Things are really kicking into gear at the moment with the Sauvignon Blanc harvest getting underway in the key growing area of Marlborough this week. And a little bit of wine trivia. Last season, 532,000 tonnes of grapes from around 700 wineries were harvested in New Zealand. The Sauvignon Blanc variety does account for about 75% of total production. We checked in with the industry group Wine Marlborough, and Marcus Pickens says that things are going well this season and yields should be on par with the long-term average. He says it's critical that the weather stays dry and windy for the quality to be maintained.
They have, but it's on that sort of knife edge. You know, there has been disease pressure with the summer we've had. Most people have been really responded to that incredibly well, but you know, you've always at the sort of slight mercy of that that rainfall coming in. We're just hoping to avoid that, and I'm sure quality will be very good.
So fingers crossed on that front. And Marcus Pickens says, thankfully, with the border restrictions now over, the supply of labour on vineyards has improved. And he says that's really good because wineries wouldn't have coped with a fourth season of not having enough experienced staff.
Managed to, you know, land a few people from overseas just to relieve that pressure. And then wineries have also responded. A number of the larger wineries have increased the amount of permanent workforce they have in the winery all year. So it's been a really good mitigation on the front of wineries. Having that core crew that are experienced, it just helps so much when you're bringing new people in for that, you know, 6 to 8 weeks or 12 weeks of work.
And we also checked in with growers down in central Otago. Speaking to viticulturalist James Dicey, he said that Pinot Noir grapes, which are destined for rosé production, as well as Chardonnay grapes, were starting to be harvested down in the south this week. He said it had been actually a really great season for grape growers there in the region, and it was exciting to see the harvest kicking off. But at the same time, he did say he was thinking of growers in the North Island who, as we know, have been pretty hard hit by severe weather.
Yeah, harvest not going to be so good up in the North Island. Rural primary school principals were among those on the picket lines during Thursday's strike, Maya.
Yes, this got a fair bit of news coverage. About 50,000 teachers from secondary, primary and area schools and kindergartens did go on strike on Thursday. And there were primary school principals who also took part. We spoke to some rural primary school principals who said that some of the challenges facing urban schools are actually magnified out in the countryside. That included Rachel Weinberg from Nakuru Primary School in rural Rotorua, who said principals' pay is determined by the number of students they have, which actually she says unfairly disadvantages those in charge of small rural schools. She says that lack of funding means that she also has to act as a relief teacher, a special educational needs teacher, part-time office manager, caretaker, cleaner, finance manager. So she said that she's wearing a lot of hats, and she actually had to take a $12,000 pay cut to go from being the deputy principal at a city school to the principal of Nakuru Primary. Another person we spoke to is Andrew King, who's the principal of Oropi School in rural Bay of Plenty, and he agreed that there's certainly no incentive to be at the helm of a small school.
You've got principals that might earn less or the same as teachers, which therefore begs the question, what's the incentive to be a principal when you're ultimately responsible for the school in a self-governed school? And also another issue is relativities to pay of secondary school principals. So a secondary principal in a school the same size as mine would be earning more.
And Andrew King says that rural schools are getting fewer and fewer applicants. He says that affects the quality of the education that rural children then receive. And he says this is at a time when students actually need more support due to COVID-19 and severe weather disruptions.
It's so important now to be a community leader as a principal, which goes beyond the school gate. And that's just how it is, and that's how it will be for the next 5 years at least, I suspect, because of climate change and the pandemic and the consequences of that, where we've got more and more complex issues with kids' needs.
So as you can see, some pretty strong feelings about this one, but no resolution as of yet.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Also this week, dairy giant Fonterra announced a pretty big profit.
Yep, pretty big numbers we're talking about here, Duncan. Fonterra has reported a 50% jump in its first half profit. That is thanks to better prices for some dairy products. So net profit for the 6 months ended January was $546 million. That compares to $346 million a year ago. Chief Executive Miles Hurrell, he did hold a bit of a briefing on Thursday where he talked to media and shareholders. And he said that the co-op's scale and diversification across markets meant that it was able to pivot to make the most of market conditions.
With less milk collected and whole milk powder prices down, we have produced less whole milk powder and moved more milk into skim milk powder and cream products, and this has had a higher return. We've also made the most of favourable margins in our protein portfolio, notably casein and caseinate and cheese products, by moving a higher proportion of the current season milk into these products, which has benefited earnings.
And in terms of the milk check, Fonterra has left its forecast farmgate milk price range unchanged at $8.20 to $8.80 per kilogram of milk solids. That's after it lowered the midpoint of that range by 50 cents last month. And Miles Hurrell did acknowledge that that's pretty close to the break-even price for many dairy farmers. And when we spoke to Fonterra farmers about Fonterra's update, they did sort of say the same thing. They were happy to see Fonterra's books in good health, but they would prefer that milk price to just have stayed a little bit higher. One of those people we spoke to was Federated Farmers Dairy Chair Richard McIntyre. He's a share milker in Horowhenua. And he says a few years ago, a payout in the $8 range, that would have spelled a hugely profitable season for all farmers. But he says in these times, it's just not the case.
Yeah, we're seeing interest rate costs, they're forecast to continue to increase over the next year and a half. Labour costs are certainly going up as well still. And most of the other costs are sort of holding steady, if not increasing slightly as well. For the average farm, the break-even milk price for this season is $8.42. So that means that it's essentially roughly half of the farmers will still be making a profit, and the other half will be starting to become cash flow negative.
And Fonterra will confirm its final milk price in September. That's all from me for now, but if you are hungry for any rural news updates during the week, then we're on air on RNZ twice daily, Monday through to Friday. Our first update is at 6:26 during Morning Report if you're an early bird, but if you enjoy more of a sleep-in, you can catch us at 12:35 during Midday Report.
Kia ora, Maya, and thank you very much for all your contributions to Country Life. It's your last one this week, so all the best.
You're listening to Country Life on RNZ National. 101 FM.
We're off to the Central District's field days now. Exhibitors, farmers and anyone interested in things agricultural are descending on Fielding in Manawa 2 this weekend to check out the latest, the best and the brightest in the world of agriculture. Amid the shiny tractors, new sheep breeds and delicious smelling spit roast, I spied a stand featuring different types of pest traps. And it seemed to be attracting quite a bit of attention, not only for the mean-looking traps out front. People were hunched over computers, finding out about a digital support system known as TrapNZ, which is connecting thousands of trappers around the country.
Andrew Saunders is my name. I'm from Ground Truth. We're the company that make Trap.NZ, which is the national system for recording trap captures, bait stations, environmental outcomes like bird monitoring, all that sort of thing.
Tell us how it works.
So depending on who you are and what sort of pests you've got and what problems you're trying to solve, we operate for, let's say you've got somewhere like the Hunua Ranges, where it's all community trappers who walk in trap lines. We map out through the system, we or they can map out where traps are, and when those people walk the line, they can record all their captures as they walk.
Record this digitally?
Record this digitally on an app. They can do it when they get home, take it off pen and paper onto the system when they sit in front of the PC at home. We have farmers who are operating remote monitored traps, so live capture traps. When they go off, they'll get a message through the system, or their neighbours will get a message as well. So it creates this buzz around communal trapping. So they know the neighbour's doing something, it spurs them to do something, and so we build all those side of things as well.
So it's a network that people can join?
It's absolutely a network. So you can create your own project, you can join any of your neighbouring projects, you can join as many projects as you like. So you could be a guy in suburbia with one Victor rat trap, or you could be somebody who's servicing thousands of traps in somewhere like the Hoonua Ranges.
So what's the attraction of doing this digitally as opposed to just having a notebook, taking it with
you? So centrally, we can see where action is happening. We can see the outcomes that come from that happening. So there's all the reporting side of it. So all the graphs and the hex maps that we put out, all publicly available. So we can see where the action is happening, where it's not. From an individual's point of view, they can see their captures building up rather than keeping it in a notepad or an Excel spreadsheet. It's actually becoming part of a big set of data that we can start working out which traps work best, in a certain way or for a certain type of operation, all of those sort of things. So it's that we're breeding efficiency into a system that's been for a long time very, very inefficient.
And DOC has come on board with this system as well?
Yes, they have. Yes, so we Walk the Line was the DOC system, which was getting to an age where it was requiring too much maintenance. And I think DOC made the no-brainer decision to join in with what the communities and the councils are already using so that we can all work together. So we have this fantastic system now where we can have a dock block next to a farmer, and they can combine resources and knowledge and be working the same trap lines and keeping it as private as it needs to be, but as open as it needs to be to get the job done.
So what are some of the results of having this kind of network that you're seeing?
So our project, I live in a lifestyle block in the northwest Waikato. We've got must be a couple of hundred people on that project, all people owning farms, all the kids, the school. They all put data into the system. They all work off the same data. They know how many pests there are. We know the farms that are cleared out. Some of our remote monitoring equipment, we've got farms where we were shooting 40 possums a night in valleys. The remote monitored equipment hasn't returned a possum in many of these traps in 18 months. Ferrets, for example. Some people knew ferrets were there. We didn't. We now know that we've taken out 230 ferrets across that area that nobody knew were there. And we're now watching quail come back and pheasant. The bird life is phenomenal from it. And because people are put into the system, they can now relate back to why that's happening. And that's the magic of the digital stuff, isn't it?
So how fast is the take-up?
Yeah, really quick. So when I first started with the company 3 years ago, I think there was 2,000 projects across the country. There's now, I think we're closing in on 6,000 projects. When DOC came on board, that doubled the database overnight, which was a headache for the developers making it handle that. But yeah, there's people here nodding. but we've done it, and it's working. So
what are the developments you're hoping to bring in future?
I love the way we get the social side going, the people talking about trapping. You know, one farmer's got a trap that's gone off, the neighbour saw it go off because his phone went buzz, and he goes, what did you catch? Oh, it was another ferret. Oh man, I must go out and check my ones as well. And it's that buzz that never would have happened. We've gone from farmers saying, well, I'm the only one doing stuff, to now, oh, I actually need to do stuff because I can see others doing it. And I think that is absolutely massive.
Should we have a look and see how some of these traps that you've got here work?
Absolutely. We've got a couple of cool traps here. This one is a community-built live capture cage with an automatic lure dispenser on it and a remote monitoring system from FerroNet. So any animal that walks into here, they might not be hungry, they're just coming in for a sniff, they'll stand on that. That'll send a message back. So let's say if we were neighbours.
So that's connected via satellite, GPS, how's it
that's
work?
Through IoT, so the Internet of Things. So that'll send a signal back to a base station, which will then send to trap.nz. And if we were neighbours, we'd both get the message. We have these on, and it's in school situations where all the parents, the PTA, they all get a message and they all talk about what's in there. go and let the neighbour's cat go, all that sort of thing. And that works brilliantly well. It creates a buzz.
Why is it important to know that you've caught something? Because you might just go and check that trap anyway.
So particularly with live capture, by law you have to check that trap every day. And to start with, when you're all excited about trapping, yeah, that's no problem. But 6 weeks into it, it's starting to get a bit laborious. Plus it means you have to put the trap where it's easy to see. But that's not where the pests are. So with this, you can put a pest down by the creek or somewhere out of sight, check it while you're having your Weet-Bix and your latte in the morning. It's all clear, we're good to go, and get on with your day. And you know, 2 years into it, that just becomes habit. You just tap that button, we're all good. And so then that's saving you an absolute fortune in terms of labour. We gained some funding to develop the Open LoRa remote monitoring system, which is what we see here. So that's free for anybody to use if they sign up to that system. So you buy a trap with one of those on it, or you buy the sensor on its own, and that's free and publicly available. And that will plug into any trap. You can put that onto a DOC 200 box or anything you like. So I think farmers are only starting to clock on to they can actually make a massive amount of difference through a little bit of effort. It used to be a lot of effort, now we're changing that very quickly.
Are you seeing many farmers here today?
Yeah, there's some really experienced farmers in this game as well, and they've all got their different stories, and they immediately see the benefit of it. They look at that and go, actually, yeah, that's what I need. Just to save my time and do the job, that's what I want. So, yeah, it's fantastic.
Andrew Saunders of Ground Truth, the land management company behind Trap NZ, which is a free service and has been going since 2014. I hope the rain doesn't put too much of a dampener on things for the field days this weekend. We'll have much more from them next week.
To Otorohoga now, where red, pink, orange and blue bags might catch your eye as you're driving down the main street. They're the craft of Dan Hickman, who spent close to 50 years designing bags for the needs of his community. From hay bale bags, caving bags, truckie bags to your saddle bag, there's not many in the town without at least one of the colourful designs. You could say he's world famous in Otorohanga.
My favourite bag would be this bag. It's called a expander bag. It's got two zips on the bottom and you unzip and it goes right around.
Gosh, it's just doubled in size.
Doubles in size at the top. But then I did that one for quite a number of years and then I put an extra one in. Triple, but the bottom one is a pocket, separate pocket.
What makes it your favourite bag? Because there's many to choose from here, obviously.
Oh, bags for Christmas, yeah. It's nice and technical to put together. You've got to be thinking all the time which way it's going together because you can muck
it up.
Yeah, that was the word I was going to think.
We're with Dan of Dan's Bags.
You are.
The name in the face of the business.
Well, that's what I thought it was. But then Dan's Bags, Christine worked it out after 40 years of hard labour that Dan's Bags stands for Durable, Affordable New Zealand Bags. So that was me put in my place.
So how long have you been doing this?
Well, I've been making bags for 49 years.
Fair go.
I started many years ago making leather shoulder bags. I got a job at Grat Outdoors Tent Factory. And I was doing different jobs there, which weren't sewing. But there was 150 women there I could sell my shoulder bags to, which was quite good because there was a few girls, they were paying them off $5 a week.
Oh, please.
And I was making more money out of shoulder bags than I was doing working at Grat Outdoors. Yeah.
Where did that passion to make those bags begin?
Begin, right. I wanted a pair of moccasin boots. Mm. I wanted that. You couldn't get them in the day. And so I wanted to make this pair of moccasin boots. I went to the leather and handcraft shop and was going to make these moccasins, but then got diverted into shoulder bags. I was working at Grat Outdoors and the sewing machine mechanic, the leather was getting very expensive for the shoulder bags, and I was sort of getting a bit over that. And the sewing machine mechanic, he said, look, I've got this fantastic sewing machine you should buy. And I said, look, I can't afford anything. Yeah, you know, I couldn't afford a sewing machine. All I've got is a 7-foot freezer at home. I can't afford to fill with bread, let alone meat. And he said, well, I'm looking for a freezer. So we swapped.
Really?
And that was my first sewing machine. And I would get the scrap out of the bin at Grad Outdoors, and I would make bags. In here, we do all the cutting here and the patterns. You roll the material out to the length you need, and then, so you might cut 30 at a time. Then it comes over to the famous banging bench.
Banging bench?
This is where we put the patterns on and then drill or bang the holes so we know where halfway is, where we start, where we finish. Over here we have webbing cutting bench that I'll show you. Now, this heats up really, really hot, and you roll it, roll your webbing out, whatever size, and so it cuts it
and just slices right through that. You be careful with your hands on that machine, eh?
Oh, yeah.
You've got Dan's Bags written on this webbing, and you've told me haven't ever done any advertising because you just put it on the bag.
The bag advertises for us. We don't advertise for the bag.
What is behind the colours? Because obviously you could do, you know, your black and white and brown standard bags, but what I see, purple, orange, blue, yellow, green.
If there is any colour we can get, we grabbed.
Try to get as many colours as we can. And we couldn't get most of those colours. We couldn't even get 6 or 7 years ago. And it's been, for us, it's been great because the type of bags that we make, it's just the colours just do it for them.
And the wholesalers in Auckland, they've been brilliant. They've brought different things in. But now
that we buy them,
they're discontinuing some colours. So it's, you know, we're just grabbing anything we can.
But what makes you want to do it in those colours?
Oh, because it's boring sewing black.
Yeah, you've got to like what you're making.
You do.
And I like colour. It's
the colours that sell. We occasionally get people coming, have you just got a black bag? And it's, we'd have to really search for a black bag, an all black bag.
You talked about, you know, the start of getting into bags. Were you with each other at the time? Mm.
Yes, we're 48 years married.
Almost 49 next month, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 49 years, We've always done stuff together.
Yeah, I do get reminded.
But we sort of have always worked in different things, and it wasn't until mid-1990s bags was very difficult, a very difficult market. There was so much cheap import, and just very difficult to compete. Well, you couldn't compete, actually. And we were also doing sportswear, you know, tracksuits and that sort of stuff. So that sort of kept us going. And then it's just got to a point where there was just so much other cheap import with that. And it ran about that time. That was about 7 or 8 years ago, I suppose it would have been. We dropped doing sportswear totally, forget it, and went into doing just bags and just developing mainly industrial stuff. It's just, we do a lot of stuff for shearers. Some of their machine bags, we do
the drop arm bag for the big arm going to the handpiece.
Yeah, big backpacks.
All the top shearers seem to have our bag.
Yeah, they love our stuff. And it's we do a lot of stuff for pest control. The guys in the area, it's pouches, it's big backpacks, it's all sorts of things. And like Blackwater Rafting, they have their special backpacks, which they tell us what they want and we do it. And that's pretty much how it works. It's just, we send stuff all over New Zealand.
Have you always been in Otorohanga?
No, we've been in Otorohanga for about 20 years.
Yeah, nearly. 2004 we moved our workshop into Otronga. Until 2020. And we were going to retire. And we thought, what are we going to do? Are we going to retire? And this shop came up. Let's just buy the shop. Why not? What else are you going to do when you retire, when you get to 65? So we did that, and it's, apart from COVID, it's been quite amazing. It's immediately raised our profile, and of course we get a lot of people coming through from Taranaki, for instance, or going to Taranaki, and it's State Highway 3. I mean, you can't really get better than that.
What is the most popular bag?
Yeah, the peg bag. It's, yeah. Oh, we sell so many of those. It's crazy.
So we're at the face of the shop now, really, aren't we? Mm.
We have tradies bags. Designed this for a plumber who was... They needed the bag to drag under houses, so it's very heavy duty. It's double-lined with PVC ripstop with canvas ripstop. It's as strong as I can make it.
And open at the top, so easy access.
Yeah, for putting tools. And then somewhere else I had... No, I think I sold it. Oh, no, here it is. The bum bag. I designed it around five cans of Waikato the day Waikato came out in cans.
No way.
Yeah. A mate of mine brought half a dozen around. He plonks these on, and so it was a hot day, so I tried one out and it worked. And I thought I could design a bag around the five. That's why it was always five.
Because you've already drunk one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
<As you do. laughs> This is a bag I designed for myself. After 40 years of designing bags for other people, I thought, I'm designing one for myself. So you put an ice pack.
In the bottom.
In the bottom. You've got two stubbies at the end. You've got six more stubbies which go inside with another ice pack standing. And then the last stubby goes in behind the ice pack. Does me
the perfect bag, really, for a good night out.
It is. Yeah, the trucking bag. You've got top pocket for your laptop or your logbook. You've got two drinks. You've got your wallet. You've got your phone.
Your secret little pocket.
You've got your torch. And you've got a bit there for your dirty magazine.
So it's all the requirements of being on the road.
Yeah.
How do you think of all the new patterns and new ideas?
Occasionally it is something a customer will ask for.
Yeah.
But very occasionally I dream about it. I've worked out a few bags which I've had problems with how to put them together. I've woken up in the morning and gone, Christine, I've got to go to work now. And I come to work and I've saved a lot of money by coming and putting it down on material.
Are you guys sort of touched on before, oh no, we'll keep going, you know, what do you do in retirement anyway? Do you see an end anytime soon to it?
Well, at the moment, yeah, we're 68. And how long do we work for? I would like to sell the business. And it's not going to be an expensive business. It's what it is. But I want to put at least 2 years into teaching, because there is so many things I've sorted out, how to make the bag, the shortcuts. You can never have too many Dan's bags.
Dan Hickman there of Dan's Bags. And you also heard from his wife, Chris.
Now we're heading to the first commercial hop farm in Southland. Cosmo Kentish Barnes is with James McNamee at Garston Hops. James says the first trial plot was planted in a paddock in 2016, and since then he hasn't looked back.
This is hop plants with sheep grazing and sleeping underneath them. So this is an example of Southland two-tier farming. So we've got the hop plants all happily growing high, and the sheep are at the bottom, and they're making good work at keeping the grass down, the weeds down, and hops do have quite a calming effect, so that'll help keep them happy as well.
How many sheep have you got in this hop garden here?
I think there's about 400 of them in here. There were 600 of the mob yesterday, but 200 got them peeled off, and there's 400 left.
The sheep on the family farm are managed by James's brother Terence and his wife Len.
We just have 800 acres now, and we run a breed called Snowline. We used to have Romneys, but nobody really wants Romneys anymore. The wool's a bit coarse, and they were getting quite hard to lamb. You've got to take good care of them. Snowline come out of Central Otago, and they are much more easy care sheep.
Was it quite a big change for you and Terence to have hops growing on some of those more productive flat paddocks?
It was, but we were on board with it. In the early days, James was away a lot and we looked after them, so we were very hands-on to start off with. When we were doing those trial plots, we dug the holes and planted them and trained them up and looked after them and worried about them. But now we've taken a step back and do the farm side of things.
Farm diversification has moved in mysterious and exciting ways.
It has, it has. It's exciting though, you know, no, we're all on board with it.
We've been farming here for 145 years. We've predominantly been doing sheep, and sheep don't do so well anymore. And so we're looking for something else that I guess suits our farm and suits our land. And the main key factor down here is the latitude of where we are. If you look where they grow hops, the Northern Hemisphere, it lines up better down here than it does further north. They like the long sunlight and daylight hours. They like the cold that we get in the evenings and the winters. They like the variation that we get here.
And how many hectares have you got in hops?
We've got 15 hectares in now, 45,000 plants in the ground.
And you're looking to expand?
Yes. Yes, we want to go out to 40 hectares here, and we want hopefully other farmers come in with us, and we'll build our own little hop community down here, and we'll have our own processing shed and our workers and build our hop community.
So you want to encourage other farmers to start growing?
Yes, most definitely. We had an open day here in January. We had 150 people turn up to have a look at that round, so other farmers are also looking to see what else they can do, or do something different. With the climate here and the state of the meat market and the wool market. So, yeah, definitely the more we get, the more we can grow together.
Has anyone else started growing hops yet, or are you still the only farmers who are doing it here?
Our neighbour has put 100 plants in as well, just down the road, so he took the title of us for the southernmost hops in New Zealand, but we'll still claim the southernmost commercial hops.
Have some people been surprised at how well they seem to be growing here?
Yeah, people have been surprised, but I guess wasn't too much of a surprise when I wandered down and saw when I first started looking at this, I wandered down and saw my first cousin down the road, Matt, who's in his 80s. He's had a hop plant on his porch for 30 years. He used that to brew his own beer. And the gold miners were down here in the 1850s and 1860s, so there's wild hops around in the hills as well. So it'd be interesting to find some of them someday and cross them with these ones and get a variety that's unique to this area.
Lynn is the family historian, and she might well have uncovered a hoppy link between the past and present.
The McNamee family started off in Skippers as gold miners, made a bit of money, and then came down here when they opened up the valley to Ballots. So they sectioned it off into 200-acre plots, because that's all you needed in those days to make a good living off a farm. And our family won the ballot, and so we came down here. It took them a few days by horse to get here, and when they came here, there was nothing.
They had no idea what it was going to be like.
No, 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 there was nothing. There wasn't a tree in the valley. It was just basically tussock like you see on the hills. And there had been some bush in the past, but most of that had disappeared. I think fires went through at some stage and took most of it out.
Back to now, and also with us at Garston Hops is hop manager Blaz Helen.
Hello, I'm from Slovenia, and I'm coming from a hop farm back home, and we are on latitude 45, and here Garston is 45. And I think the sun and the soil here in New Zealand can bring some special hop flavors.
How did you connect with James?
We had a hop congress in 2019 in Slovenia, and I met a manager from Nelson Farm, and he invited me to New Zealand. And yeah, of course, I want to see how the New Zealand hop industry is going. So yeah, I took it the opportunity straight away. Mm. And then somehow opportunity opened to come to Garston and to manage the Garston hop farm. And yes, opportunity which needs to be taken.
How many generations have your family been growing hops for?
So it's a fifth hop generation hop farm. We have also some beef production. We have some cereals, so it's a bit of a mixed farm. But hops was always on the farm.
What's the difference between hops and hop production here compared to in Slovenia?
I always say maybe a bit easier in New Zealand because you don't have that much pests and that much diseases. So back home, we need to take care more of the pest management and of diseases management. But here in New Zealand, the hop plant doesn't really need any diseases management, so we don't need to spray the plants. And if you can grow the hops without pesticides, the brewers are happy and also the end customer. And we don't need to interrupt our ecosystem, so everyone's happy on the end.
Where do you get your hop stock from?
We started growing them ourselves, but it wasn't economically worth us doing, so we just get them from the nurseries up in Nelson.
Yeah. So how many varieties of hops are growing in this hop garden here?
So we have five varieties, and that's Motueka, Nelson Savan, Rakau, Cascade, and Riwoka. We will harvest them separately, and we'll harvest them on a different day.
Some might require an extra day or two.
Yeah. Right now we are seeing that Motueka and Cascade will be the first ones.
And when is harvesting starting?
Yeah, that's up for debate at the moment, but yeah, somewhere between the 15th and the 17th of March, we think.
Blaz, as hop manager, what are you doing at the moment as harvesting quickly approaches?
Yes, we are testing now every day each variety. So we are checking the dry matter of the cones, and then we're also putting up our harvest machinery together, and we want to test our harvester at least 1 week before, and then we're ready to start the harvest.
Has a lot of machinery been made especially for this hop garden?
Yes, because it's one of the first hop farms here. It's really hard to get the machinery. So I had a challenge in December, so I built a wine picker that will extract the wines and will get the leaves and the cones, and then we send the leaves and the cones through the leaf extractor and then on the cleaning line, and we get just the cones, and then the leaves could be a feed for our sheeps, and the wines will compost them and we can put them back in the hop garden.
Very clever.
Thank you.
And I can see some irrigation there. How important is that, being such a dry summer?
Yes, it's kind of dry here in that valley right now, but we have a good irrigation system. We have all hop gardens are under drip irrigation, and for good quality hops, you need a lot of amount of water, but because we have drip irrigation, we can put that water next to the hop plant, and we can actually use less than if we had a sprinkler irrigation system.
Now that you're here and working at a hop garden, what do you see that's unique about hops that are grown here?
I think the most unique system for me will be that connection with the sheep farm and hop farm. So actually, in Slovenia or in Europe, I didn't know that system that we can put the sheep into the hops. So usually we do our wheat management we do with mechanical way, so we do with cultivation. But here in New Zealand, usually we have sheep in the hop garden, and actually the sheep are the wheat management, and they also like to eat the hop bottom leaves. So that's really good, because if they eat the bottom leaves, we will get more light into the hop garden. So actually sheep farm and hop farm are the best combination of farming.
Did you know this, James, when you first started growing hops?
Well, a wise man would say yes, but I have to be totally honest and say no. No, didn't know that. Stumbled into it. We're learning as we go. And as Blas was saying, they go hand in hand, the sheep and the hops. So Terence, my brother, looking after the sheep, and Blas looking after the hops. So we're just learning that we've got to go together and talk about what we're doing and how they go and where the sheep are going next and how to control things.
Mm. Let's go up and have a look at the hops to see how they're doing. How big are these cones now, would you say?
So we have still this variety, which is Cascade. We have small cones, but we can slightly see inside the lupulin development. That's the yellow powder, and this is what we need to have for good quality beer.
So Blaz has just rubbed one of the cones, and it's opened up, and you can see some yellow inside.
Yeah, that's the lupulin, which is high with alpha and beta acids. And because it's aroma hops, it's also high with essential oils. And that brings to the beer like citrus flavors, mango flavors, some tropical fruits. And these are all coming from essential hop oils.
Do the sheep like to eat the cones?
Yeah, it's very interesting that if the plant falls on the ground and the sheep can reach them, they will eat just the leaves. Because our cones, which is our commercial product, it's bitter inside because of that lupulin powder, and the sheep will not eat the cones.
James, do these plants just get bigger and bigger? I mean, how long do they stay in the ground?
They stay in the ground for 20 to 25 years. So the crown that's in the ground will get bigger. So what you're seeing now is the plant coming out of the ground. You chop it off when we take it away to harvest it, and it'll grow new shoots again next year.
So you chop it right down at the base?
Yeah, well, you chop it about 4 to 6 inches above.
Yep.
But the crown itself in the ground is probably the size of your fist now, and it'll get bigger and bigger and bigger to the size of your head underground. And all the energy goes into the air for the winter, and it sits there dormant, and then it'll start again and grows, the roots grow out and the shoots go up again. So the American system have different height. What height do you have over in Europe?
Yeah, so in Europe we'll have a higher hop trail, so we'll be like 7 meters high. But this I call like American style of growing. So there are 4.5 meters high wires, and we don't want to go any more higher because it's more harder to reach higher aromas. Mm. So 4.5, it's more for aroma hop varieties, which we have here in New Zealand.
So you mean the height of the plant can affect the aromas that the cones will display?
Yes, it's easier that we stop the plant earlier so the plant can focus on flowering and aroma development.
At the top wire, the hop plants tend to just flop over, don't they?
Yes, they will flop over, and when the plant will start flowering depends on the sun. So actually the hop plant can know exactly which day of the year is, and when the day starts shortening, the plants will slowly start putting all that energy into the flowering.
They've got a very good memory.
Yes, they are kind of very smart. They are cannabis family. So we have male plants and female plants, and that female flowers cones, these are commercial product which is important for us. But for the male varieties, we need to take a look to don't have them, because if we have just one of them, then they can pollinate our females and the quality will go lower.
Now, James, is the hop garden behind the windbreak a bit younger? They look smaller.
Yeah, they are younger. So the one we're in now is the second year crop. So it takes hops about 3 years to get up to full speed. We planted that one on Labour weekend. So we'll get a harvest off that this year, but it might be about 40% of what it will be when it gets up to full noise. And then there's a third paddock over here that we planted between Christmas and New Year.
Oh, yeah.
But we won't harvest that one. They're just in the ground, getting nice and happy in their little homes, ready for next year.
This time next year, they'll be, what, 4 or 5 metres
yes.
tall?
They're very quick. On some days in December and January, they can grow 15, 20 centimetres sometimes in a day.
Why are New Zealand hops in so much demand in Europe?
Yeah, the craft market is still expanding. If I compare the Europe craft market with New Zealand, we are in Europe still behind. So we are still expecting to expand the craft market a lot. And for good craft beer, you need unique hops. You need good aroma hops. And New Zealand aroma hops, it's known as one of the best ones with some of really unique aromas. And if you want to make a really good beer, you need really good hops. And maybe really good hops wasn't being important that much 20, 30 years ago. But right now, because all these craft beers, IPAs, hazy IPAs, they're looking for special, unique flavors.
Yes, and do people pay a lot more for New Zealand hops in Europe?
Yes, yes. The New Zealand hops in Europe will be really hard to get, and it will be one of the most expensive ones.
James, are you finding that the hops are starting to display flavors that speak of or capture this particular area?
Yeah, definitely. It's something that's starting to express itself in the beers now. The brewers are feeding back that our hops are a bit more citrusier, a bit more punchier. But yeah, definitely that will be something we want to have in part of our community, that we want to be known. This year wants to be known as South and Southern hops with a different taste that people want to look for.
Do you have breweries contacting you to find out what you're doing?
Yes, we've got the Wanaka and the Queenstown breweries and one from Invercargill that buy our hops, and then we're just looking to expand on that. But they'll be all coming up here in a few weeks' time. Last year we had 5 breweries turn up for fresh hops. They all turn up, they turn their vat on, they've got boiling away, they drive here, they get their bag of hops, they have a race to see who can make the first fresh hop beer and who can make the best one.
That must be a fun day when they're all here getting
busy.
Their hops.
It's busy, it's challenging, but it's good. But we encourage the brewers to come down and look at the hops and help select which ones they want to do. When hops are ready, there's about a 9-day window for each variety, so they can choose if they want them in the middle or the end or the beginning, because they're a slightly different expression of the taste.
Mm. Is there a particular beer you like that is already using your hops? Can you single one out?
There's a few that are quite good. My favourite fresh hop one last year was one that Ryan Reason did, called Oops, I Did It Again. That was a really good fresh hop one. But my mainstay one would be Altitude, do one called Mischievous Care. That's one of their signature beers, and they do it with our hops, and it's very good.
How important is it for you, James, that you get the community behind you on this?
It's very important. We're Gus and hops, so we're Gus and community. I grew up here, and you went out and you helped your neighbours, and we all did your hay together. You all took turns doing one what and next one, and that was great. It was lovely summer days. We were out working together, and you had a good community feel. But we need a lot of people around the harvest. Over the last 100 years, our community has gone backwards in numbers because people move away, they go to the town for school and they never come back again, so this could be a way to help reverse that trend as well.
Lynn, will you be involved in the harvest?
I will, actually. I have 2 jobs in the harvest. One job is cook. So we feed all our staff morning tea, lunch, afternoon tea, and that involves cooking for 20 people for a good 3 weeks. So that's my main job. And my other job is tour guide. We get a lot of people wanting to come through and see the hops, as you can imagine. And so in the harvest time, Blas, James, and all the other workers are way too busy.
So you take people around the hop gardens to show them how it all works?
Yes, yes. I had a group from Tiana a couple of weeks ago came in, and they were on their way to Queenstown in a bus and called in, and several have already booked in to come during harvest time.
For people who'd like to come and visit the hop garden, how can they get hold of you?
We've got a Facebook page, Guston Hops, so we can't accommodate too many people, but yeah, we can do a few.
Lynn McNamee ending that story from Garston Hops in Northern Southland. Cosmo was also talking to Lynn's brother James and hop manager Blas Helen. To see some photos of the hop harvest that's just got underway, go to the RNZ's Country Life webpage.
And that's all we've got time for this week. Have a great weekend. Bye now.
Ka kite anō.